equivalent.
For people with parents.
You can remind me of that.
I must have you. So, you must come back and.
Well, why?
No, that one died when it was 22 years ago. But the little one, you had a hair on it.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah. So we didn't get the same, but we were supposed to come back.
Yeah. You didn't get the same.
Huh?
You didn't get the same.
No, you can live in an area of that.
Yeah. Okay, we'll start with our prayers first. So again, as we say the prayers, you know, like His Holiness says, it's not very hard work. It's not very hard work. And the main part is really about generating a sense of interest and emotion also, where you really think with real gratitude and openness about who our teachers are and the condition of suffering and samsara and how important our spiritual attitude and interest is. And so therefore, you know, first of all, really think about our mother sentient beings, those who are challenged and suffering in cyclic existence. And then with a real sense of respect and interest in our teachers, then we'll do the refuge prayer. So let's just sit for a moment and contemplate that. You know, everyone here has someone, if not ourselves, who is challenged in samsara through sickness or problems and difficulties in life. So, you know, really think how important it is for us to contemplate and practice generosity and kindness in our spiritual paths. And when we say the prayers, you can think of His Holiness the Dalai Lama or your spiritual mentor, so that when you're saying them, you have your teacher listening to you and hearing your prayers. Okay? I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. So go through Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, and the first verse is really inviting the teachers to come before us. Can you hear me okay? In the back? All right. Okay. So the first verse is inviting Lama Tsongkhapa to appear before you. So again, as in saying your requests and prayers, imagine saying them to an enlightened being who really hears you and understands your requests and prayers. From the heart of the Lord of the Ganden Devas, emerges a brilliant white cloud, like a great mass of fresh yogurt. Atop sits Tsongkhapa, all-knowing king of Dharma. We request your coming to this place, along with your great disciples. My Lord Guru is seated before me, on a lion throne, lotus, and moon cushion. His white face smiles blissfully. Please remain many eons, and serve as the supreme merit field for the growth of my mind of faith and for the increase of Lord Buddha's teachings. Your omniscient wisdom mind encompasses all that is existent. Your speech is a profound teaching which ornaments the ear of the fortunate. Your body's beautiful radiance evokes wonders, admiration. I prostrate to you, Lama Tsongkhapa, who merely viewing, hearing, or contemplating earns one great merit. So this next verse is the verse of offerings. So make your offerings as beautiful as you can. Again, thinking about the things that we appreciate and take for granted every day. For you who've just come back from India, you know, think about all the goodies that you get to enjoy for the month that you're here, that we just take for granted, you know, that we have easy access to all the time, which otherwise is hard to get in India and in many places around the world that are extremely hard or if not impossible to get. So, you know, really appreciate those things and imagine offering them to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, to your teachers, and to all sentient beings. You know, this also helps us to generate a mind of generosity in our own hearts, you know, realizing that the things we have really came from good karma, came from the opportunity of our excellent birth, of being born in a place where, and the karma to have these things available to us. So with that, you know, think about things that we utilize every day, without even thinking about them, and generate a sense of appreciation for them and imagine offering them to everyone, everywhere. So you can even offer simple things for us, that, like running water, a bed without bed bugs, food, great refrigerators, and things, good heaters and air conditioning. So imagine offering them without any sense of loss, realizing that at death we leave it all behind anyway. Yeah? So we'll say the verse of offering. I present to you, supreme field of merit, Tsongkhapa, delightful offerings, pure sweet water, various flowers, fragrant incense, butter lamps, perfumes, and more. Both physical and mental offerings, vast as the clouds and wide as the ocean. And the next verse is the verse of purification. So you might think, you know, over the past couple days, were there any things that we transgressed regarding our promises to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you know, our promises of generating kindness to others, practicing patience, and avoiding actions that harm ourselves and others through our body, speech, and mind. So you might call a specific incidents, who you were with, what happened, and declare it. Now imagine declaring that to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and generating a sense of acknowledging and a sense of regret at having done those things. And make a promise not to engage in that action again for a specific amount of time that you can keep. if you can promise not to engage in that negativity again for your entire life, then you can say, for my entire life. But if it's a nagging, perpetual delusion or a negative action that occurs, then try to keep it for a specific amount of time. And we'll recite the next verse. The unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind I have accumulated since time without beginning, especially actions contrary to my vows. Vinaya, Bodhisattva, Vajrayana, I regret extremely from the depths of my heart and reveal each and every such action. And so the next verse is the limb of rejoicing and appreciating our teachers and what they have given us, you know, have turned our mind, have turned ourselves onto the Dharma, to the importance of our spiritual path and practice. So think about how important these teachers have been and all the excellent actions that beings have engaged in, both worldly and spiritual, you know? Because positive, virtuous actions result in happiness, result in good karma. So really acknowledge that. It gives us natural energy. So think about those things, both ordinary and from our holy teachers. And we'll recite the next verse. We totally rejoice in your magnificent achievements, my Lord. You strove for knowledge and realization, abandoned the eight worldly concerns, and made the most meaningful use of human life with the 18 opportune conditions during these degenerate times. So this next limb is the limb of requesting teachings. So let's request teachings of love and compassion, understanding the path to enlightenment, the path of the bodhisattvas. Pray all you holy gurus, unerring in conduct, precipitate a rain of vast and profound dharma from the billowing clouds of wisdom and compassion which fill the Dharmakaya sky, providing for the field of disciples precisely what is needed. And the next verse is really requesting our teachers to remain with us. And it also creates the causes for us to meet our teachers again and again. So we'll recite that verse. May the Vajra body, created from the purity of clear light, free of the rising and setting of cyclic existence, but visible to the ordinary viewer, only in its unsubtle physical form, stay on unchanging, without waning, until samsara ends. The last verse is of the verse of dedication. So dedicating all your virtue towards enlightenment, towards continuing to benefit all beings and to deepen our understanding of the Dharma. May whatever virtue I have gathered here beneficially serve all sentient beings and the Buddha Dharma, and especially may the essential teachings of the unerring master Sankapa shine forever. And this is like the long mantra of Lama Tsongkhapa, who was the founder of the Gelugpa tradition. So we'll recite this three times. Jay Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Vasankapa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Jai Sankapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Vasankapa, and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Jai Sankapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of all forces of demons. At your feet, famed Vasankapa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. So the next verse is inviting your Lama. Again, a visualization made of light, made of your pure imagination. Very tiny. Imagine inviting Lama Tsongkhapa to the crown of your head, facing in the same direction as you. So feel that energy, that enlightened energy, just above the crown of your head. And very tiny image made of light. And we'll recite that verse. Glorious, precious Rukru, please take the lotus seat at my crown. And in your kindness, please care for us. Bestow upon us the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. And the next verse, you imagine that Lama Tsongkhapa dissolves into light, descends through the crown of your head, and floods your body, speech, and mind with light. Just instantly washing away any confusion or benightedness, filling your body, speech, and mind with light and energy and clarity. And we'll recite the next verse. Glorious, precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness, care for us. Grant us your blessings for our temporal success and for the supreme enlightenment. So you imagine Lama Tsongkhapa again appearing, very tiny, made of light, descending and sitting at the lotus at your heart chakra, non-different than your own enlightened potential. And we'll recite the last verse. Glorious, precious Rukru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness remain with us. Remain steadfast until we achieve the essence of enlightenment. So bring to mind any of your comprehension of dependent origination, how things do not exist as they appear to us in our ordinary consciousness of being permanent, solid, pleasurable, and made of an independent self, right? And so we'll go through the Seat of Wisdom Sutra and the mantra. unthinkable, inexpressible, wisdom gone beyond, unborn, unceasing, space-like in essence, clearly perceived by wisdom mind, homage to the mother of the Buddhas of the three times. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. We'll do the mandala offering. By the virtue of offering to you, assembly of Buddhas, visualize before me this mandala built on a base, resplendent with flowers, saffron water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and moon. May all sentient beings share its effects. Iram Guru Ratna Mandala Kamniya Tayami. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly from the virtuous merit of sharing the teachings. May I attain Buddhahood and the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly from the virtuous merit of sharing the teachings. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. From the virtuous merit of sharing the teachings, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. So what we went through in the Guru Yoga is also called the Seven Limb Puja, and they say that's very a very good practice to do, the seven limbs, before one engages in meditation or in your daily practice, because it just kind of helps clear the mind and settle it and establish clarity before you actually practice. So it is a very good, very short one to do before you do your regular meditation. So as you know when we do it in Tibetan, we do it like that. So you can do it as fast or as extensive as you want, and really kind of expand it and cultivate it. Work with one particular verse, and if you like. So many things you can work with in there. So 2 weeks ago, we worked on loving kindness, really looking at the quality of loving kindness. So I wanted to extend a little bit further from this loving kindness. And do you remember, we discussed, for those of you who are here 2 weeks ago, the qualities of loving kindness, you know, where that there, it's a very free and open place, it's accepting of others, it allows others to be who they are, you know, it recognizes our own unrealistic needs and how we grasp at others when we are filled with other emotional attitudes, and it's not filled with self-interest, but love is really free-flowing and engaged in the interest of others much more. So what did we discuss 2 weeks ago? What was the near enemy of loving-kindness?
Self-interest,
self-cherishing. Mm-hmm. Part of it. Attachment. Okay, attachment. And how does it manifest? Did you observe over the last couple of weeks how attachment arises?
One of the characteristics is closeness or proximity that you mentioned 2 weeks ago. I don't know how that.
Closeness.
You have to be distance yourself from the object. I think you mentioned that.
Uh-huh. Well, I think if there's strong clinging attachment, then we have to watch, because that's different than real loving, open kindness towards others. But if there's a clinging and grasping and a neediness that's there, then sometimes we do need to have a sense of separation in order to watch and observe that we don't just fire up the delusion more, you know, and that it's something that we can generate a more healthy relationship with. Yeah. Okay. So any other recollections?
Mm-hmm. Are you asking for experiences?
Sure.
I played music with some friends.
Yeah.
And we had very different ideas about how things should go in a rehearsal or performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize the attachments I had to
your style.
Yeah, and things going a certain way. I didn't know. And we were playing a couple nights ago, and I, in the middle of it, I just thought, "Wow, this is different. You know, this is not what you know."
It's not going my way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's going my way.
Yeah.
And it took me out of the moment,
mm-hmm.
and out of what was happening, mm-hmm. good or bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes, you know, when it's my view versus everybody else's view, then it's not going to sound quite right, you know. The music and the rift or however you call it, is not going the way you want it. Yeah, you watch that also in relationships, you know. It's not going the way you want it in your own view. Okay. So, okay, so that's more like what's called the near enemy, because there's a corruption of the view of love and loving kindness. You know, it appears to be kind and appreciative, but in fact, it's much more engaged in itself and in its own interests. And there's a sense of dissatisfaction and neediness that's not being fulfilled, because you want, you know, something else in there. It's like you're filling this gap. Remember we went over how when there's the sense of neediness, when there's that arises, you can never fill it, because we keep looking for that satisfaction outside in things and people, that we keep trying to fill this empty pit, this hole that can't be satisfied. So that's when we fall into different kinds of addictions and attractions and, you know, keep thinking, like in relationships, yeah, we start to strangle the relationship because we want something out of that to fulfill what's not working in ourselves, this sense of dissatisfaction, right? So to watch how, you know, when we're saying, "I love you," it's really saying, "I need you," or "Don't you dare leave me," or any other permutations of that, you know, that in fact it becomes unhealthy rather than something that's engaged and warm and loving and open and free, you know, allowing the person to be who they are. Okay, so there's something that's also called the far enemy of love, and what might that be? Okay, we're looking at loving kindness, which we all is all very appealing to us, you know, but as we cultivate this sense of loving kindness, then, you know, we have to look at where we kind of get derailed and we fall off the chair, so to speak. So what might the far enemy be?
Would it be the delusion of seeing objects as self-existent and going to that?
Oh, we do that even with the mere enemies. Uh-huh, Melinda?
Are you talking about aversion? That would be the opposite.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, aversion and hatred. Uh-huh.
Hate.
You're right on the button. You got it. Yeah, hatred and anger. And there are different ways of working with that and watching how, you know, it arises with us too. You know, hatred and anger. Hatred kind of has a much more powerful and intense intensity about it. And you watch how it kind of manifests in two different ways. Hatred and anger arise in two different ways. So one way might be when, you know, it's almost like it's so full of energy. It's just blasting out. You know, it's like you have the intensity of the hate is so strong, you don't know if it's coming at you or coming or going out of you. No, ever experienced that? Yeah, it's so strong and so powerful. And in fact, you know, you're just incinerating everything in your space around you because of this hatred and anger. Do you ever get that? You're so little. Yeah, but you know what it feels like when you're getting upset at something, right? Yeah. So, you know, it's like watching how we're all striving for happiness. We all want happiness and we don't want suffering. And this loving kindness is something that we all crave, yet we get stuck in its other kinds of delusory manifestations, right? We talked about how it's the delusions that get us, you know? And in fact, how, you know, what we're made up of are these sensory aggregates, right? Objects of, that we have a eye sense object, or eye sense perception that perceives an object, eye, so sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and then mental objects, right? So they say that's why it's called that we live in the desire realm, right? The desire realm. We're actually more like pleasure-seeking magnets, right? Pleasure-seeking magnets. You realize with every one of our senses, our eyes are constantly seeking out things that are going to please our eye sense. Yeah, ears wanting to hear only pleasant sound and not hear aversive sound. Smell, we only want nice smells. Not like in India, right? It gets very raw in India. Yeah. Taste, touch, yeah. You realize with every one of our senses, all we want are the pleasurable things. And we don't want to have things that are aversive to us. And so in doing that, because we operate that way, you know, we keep thinking and feeling that, well, I'm looking for love and I want to give love and loving kindness to others, but in fact, you know, we're rigged up in the sense of being machines that just seek out pleasure. Yeah, we're just craving and grasping after these things, wanting more and more pleasure. And so it makes it hard for us to really just develop any sense of satisfaction and contentedness. No? That's why they say we live in the desire realm. It's like Geshe Sonam Rinchen, you know, the image of him when someone says, why are we living in the desire realm? And all he did was just go, right? To me, it was such a powerful act in the way of realizing every one of our senses is just seeking pleasure. No? And when we're just seeking pleasure, then, you know, we think we're going to transform that into a sense of love, you know, but what it is neediness, dissatisfaction. So to watch, you know, how that occurs in us. So, okay, so this near enemy, right, which is this sense of attachment, then really becomes something that's kind of tweaked and sour, you know? It's not quite there, even though we're wanting love ourselves, you know, but with hatred and anger, you realize that it's rather painful and volatile and dangerous, actually. Yeah, that it could be explosive and really damage ourselves and others. That's why, here, right, let's read this together. This is from Shantideva. Whatever wholesome deeds, such as venerating the Buddhas and practicing generosity, that have been amassed over a thousand eons, will be destroyed in one moment of anger. Okay, you can stop there. In one moment of anger, okay? That all we generated through our actions, of our virtuous actions of kindness and caring for others, can just be incinerated by our anger and hatred. It's so powerful. But His Holiness the Dalai Lama talks about how, well, actually, our virtue can be divided again into two. And so, you know, there's virtue that's cultivated through actions like generosity, practicing patience, and ethical conduct, and being kind to others. So those kind of things, you know, those are called virtues that actually can be burned up in one moment of anger. Okay? And then the other kinds of virtue would be the virtue that we've accumulated through this understanding of an insight into the nature of phenomena. So any comprehension that we have of emptiness, you know, of our non-independent nature, of our understanding in that way, then they say that virtue won't be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. What about cultivation of compassion? Could that be destroyed?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if it's dedicated? Isn't dedication supposed to protect
us? Isn't dedication supposed to protect us? Yes, it does, but you realize when anger comes how devastating that can be. But yeah, I don't know. It's what His Holiness said. You know, even our compassionate acts can be wiped out by anger and hatred. So, you know, you realize how powerful this delusion of anger is. Okay, and remember, 2 weeks ago we talked again about looking at how we create the delusion. Yeah. When delusion arises, then that is the defilement that causes, that perpetuates the negative actions. So again, there are causes of not eliminating the latent tendencies to engage in the defilement. Do you remember? Latent being? Hidden or not so evident, you know, they're kind of below the surface, that right now we're not really angry, but if I kept the class going until 3 o'clock, you might start generating a sense of irritation. That when your tummy is hungry, you know, you watch this mind of irritation that arises as well. So, you know, looking at how we need to take care of our basic needs in order to really keep our minds happy and free of the delusory mental attitudes. Okay, so the because we haven't eliminated the latent tendencies, and then close association with objects prone to those delusions. So if we're prone to be angry around certain situations, then we should be careful and watch that we don't just continually hang out where the anger is going to be fired up in us. Okay, any good examples from the audience?
Question.
Yeah.
Is it correct to say that so you have the latent tendencies, and those also called the seeds that were ripening through the delusion?
Yeah, you could say that.
And then the seeds are from a previous misconception?
Right. Sure. Previous misconception or karma. Yeah. That we created the karma. So this is why we need to also watch, you know, the karma and delusions. Those are the things that fire up our negativities and our engaging negative actions. Hey, Robert, you had one?
Well, going back to the previous example of the music venue.
The music venue,
they
yeah.
They had sports on. It was like a sports bar. And there were a handful of people, probably 10 of them, that were yelling in unison, expletive of patriots, you know, and carrying on. And I thought, well, that's not really a conducive environment to hearing subtleties in music or harmony. It's more about us versus them. And so that wasn't a good environment to remain for a long period of time.
Uh-huh.
Regardless of how loud we played, you know.
So then you try to overwhelm them, right?
Yes.
Pacify.
Hum them back to, you know, yeah, right, to harmony.
Uh-huh. Okay. Manila?
Well, not to be with negative friends, that might draw you into their realm of being.
Right. Okay, that's a good one. Not to hang out with negative friends that fire up the delusions. Melinda?
Oh, I was thinking of, with our hula group, we've got one gentleman that likes to work out at the same time we do in the area next door. He gets very upset if our music is at all too loud or at all facing that part of the room. So what we do is we have to turn it down and everything, but if we forget, it's a great source of upset and anger for everybody involved. So, you know, it's kind of like, well, you know, we just have to adjust our environment a bit, mm-hmm, kind of avoid that.
You mean it's upsetting for everyone because he gets angry and then it comes back at you?
Yes. And then we get defensive and he gets upset and it builds and builds and builds.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting how that happens, huh? Uh-huh, David.
What if the negative friends are in your family?
Not about my own family, right, but somebody else's. right. Yeah, it's very challenging. Well, this is where we'll go into some of this. Maybe I will, okay? Yeah, because, you know, it's like this is where our practice comes in, right? One of the things that Shantideva also says is that we can't cover the world with leather when there are thorns about, right? But we can put shoes on our feet. We can cover our feet with leather. So looking at how we can protect ourselves and looking at the mental attitude of really protecting ourselves when we go into those situations, you know, like don't live with them might be helpful.
Throw out all the kids.
Huh?
Throw out all of our children.
Throw out the kids, like boarding school, right? Yeah. Yeah, it's very, very hard and a powerful practice because, you know, you realize that sometimes they're in our family, sometimes they're in our working environment, sometimes it's, you know, just any little thing can irritate us. And then you realize, too, you know, we keep projecting it out there, just like that person's going to bring me satisfaction. You know, it's like that person is causing me all the harm, and therefore I'm upset, and if they would just change the way they act, then life would be great, you know, and we keep projecting it out there. Mm-hmm, Robert?
It's also said that they're more precious to our practice, right, which is a jewel, because the person that brings whatever it is out of you is the one that you can really get a lot of teaching from, a lot of mileage.
Right, right.
Yes, teacher.
Yeah. The precious one, right.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, it's like when I was, Thupten Chodron was really helping me get started in the teaching. And so she invited me up to a retreat in Washington, and I was just so nervous, and I was just totally reading everything, and it was only leading a meditation about the Buddha, and I was going, okay, visualize the Buddha before you, you know, like, you know, like but it was so hard for me to get into the teaching, and there was this one student who signed up for an interview with me, and then she came to see me, and she walked in and she said, "You're my precious teacher." And it was really painful, you know, because I know what she was getting at. But you know, it's this thing of how do you keep turning your practice into something that's going to be transformative, you know, because we struggle at first with difficult people, or we struggle our entire lives with difficult people, and how do we keep developing again the muscle to be able to handle this, you know, and that part of it is developing peace in ourselves and then developing peace in our relationships with others, because there's a real challenge to that we get very hard on ourselves, thinking, you know, that oh, well, now I'm a practicing Buddhist, then I shouldn't have any more anger and attachment. You know, I shouldn't have these things. But, you know, you get the very experience and exercise with it all the time. You know, I mean, like, His Holiness is an incredible example of the practice of patience. Now, another thing Chodron did one time, she gave a talk on patience and anger, and I thought, oh, that's so great, it's so cool, yeah, it's really wonderful. And so then, I forget where I went, I gave a talk on anger, and I made everybody angry. And I realized that it's a really hard topic to teach, you know, because it plugs in people a lot to their own stuff. And anger is much more difficult to work with because, you know, it's unpleasant. It's unpleasant. It's a tough one, and it hurts those painful places. Now, attachment we can kind of laugh at, and you can see, but the anger is much more difficult to work with, actually, because of its painful aspects. However, you know, they say that the whole attachment side then is more difficult to get rid of, because it's pleasant, you know, because of its seeming to be a friend. You know, you sidle up to it thinking that it's really going to be helpful to you. So then it's actually more difficult to work with. Okay. Uh-huh, Rani.
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, the reason we call this practice is because we have to practice all the time.
The reason we call it practice is,
you know, it's fairly easy to start with the guy in the checkout line that has 15 items and 12 items or less line, you know, wrangling with him for a second, and get over it.
Right.
And then go up to the guy at the hula class that we, you know, see a week or something like that.
Yeah.
And then finally, you know, with the family, is the hardest, because we have a lot invested in that relationship, and I think it's really hard for all of us. It's really easy for us to show compassion to relative strangers and the homeless guy on the street and everything, but a lot harder where it's really deep with the people that we, you know, we have the most invested with, which is usually our families, like you said.
Yeah, that's true. It's much harder. So the graduated path, right, to working with our delusion of anger, very hard. Yeah. So, yeah, let's look at some of these with anger. You know, it's not an emotion that we can control. Right? It's just like attachment. Again, control is an illusion. Right? We think we can handle it and just put it down and ratchet it down. But in fact, when it arises, you know, it's how do we work with it? So a big part of the practice then is looking at how, you know, these emotions and delusions, when they arise, aren't something that we can really control. And our point of power then is watching how we deal with it when it does arise. You know, when it arises, what do we do with it? When anger comes up, you know, we usually, one side is explode, right? Where we're just blasting out all the most painful, hurtful words, you know, how some people kind of store them up, like ammunition. You know, they've got their cache someplace, and they're just piling it all up, and then they can just use it to, you know, shotgun blast it and make sure that they wipe out everything in sight, right? So then there's another kind of anger, right, which is the cold, frozen, unmoving one, where you just get the cold shoulder, I don't know, any suggestions from the crowd?
Deafening
silence. Right? Like, you should know why I'm angry. You're my spouse, right? You're supposed to intuitively know exactly what's making me upset here. Right? Uh-huh, Melinda.
Well, what's the matter? Well, nothing.
Nothing, yeah, right. There's one summer I spent up at Shambhala Mountain Center in the Rocky Mountains, and we had to do a lot of meditations in these rooms where you hold a particular posture related to the different Buddha families. No, and then the one is called the Vajra room, which is blue. It's got these blue lights and shapes, particular shapes related to that particular Buddha family and element. No, and Vajra is blue, and it talks about how the fluid motion is water. You know, water is fluid, and then it goes to the other extreme of being frozen. And you look at the qualities of it when we're working with it, of, you know, how you can move through things with your energy, but then it can turn into a torrential hurricane and tidal wave. You know, you look at water in the way of that energy, where you love the beautiful waves, you know, and then the surfers go out because they're 10-footers and 20-footers. Yeah, but then they turn into 50-footers and 80-footers, right? And you realize that it's wiping out everything and just devastating things. You look at anger in that sense of just being wiping out everything in its wake. You know? And then the other kind of energy, where it turns into frozen, icy, solid, glacier. Yeah, or ice crystals, yeah, that can totally wipe you out.
Lifeless.
Lifeless. Yeah, right. So we would sit in the or lie in these particular postures in these rooms. We'd have to stay for an hour in a particular posture, and consider the elements in this way, you know, of what happens to that energy within you. Because we have the water element inside of us, but you watch when it goes through that extreme, you know, of wipe out and then freezing. It's really quite powerful to sit, you know, like for a whole week watching that particular energy inside yourself. So yeah, you know, a big part of working with this energy of anger and hatred then is allowing and watching it when it arises in ourselves, yeah, rather than running at the effect of it. Because usually you realize when it arises, it's something that is, right, whenever there's a stimulus, it's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And remember how we're heat-seeking pleasure machines, pleasure magnets, right? And so if the pleasurable sensation arises, right, you want more of it, you want to kind of play with it a little bit more, you want to possess it and own it, you want to go buy it. But if it's something that is unpleasant, then you watch how you want to push it away, wipe it out, destroy it, get away from it as quickly as you can. And so this energy of aversion comes up and you watch, right, how you work with it. So it just starts with that stimulus, again, with our sense organs. You know, object of sights, a sound, smell, taste, touch. You know, and really looking at the energy of who we are in that. And so it's just this pleasure or unpleasant sensation arises, and then rather than just acknowledging it's unpleasant, yeah, you want to destroy it. Yeah, we just rise up and act out on it, act upon it. So to realize, yeah, when we're working with the practice, remember there's that aspect called realizing the three circles. Do you remember? Do you know the three circles of an object, of an exchange?
Mm-hmm. The perceiver, the perceived, and the interaction between.
Yeah, the perceiver, the perceived, and the interaction between them. Very good. Yeah. No, it's like realizing that a stimulus arises or a person arises in your awareness. And when anger arises, then you realize then there's this stimulus between you. Or an interaction occurs that's unpleasant and you act upon it. But in fact, with all three objects, they're all empty of any inherent existence. Yeah, you are empty of any separate, independent, self-existent in existence. So is the person or the object and the interaction that occurs. And so this is all arising again through your own karma. Now you realize that it is your karmic ripening that this particular experience occurs. No? Because, right, this you run into that unpleasant person, say that unpleasant or difficult or challenging family member, but there's somebody out there in the universe who thinks that person is charming, yeah, and wonderful, and lovable. Yeah. But if that person were inherently embodying hatred and aversion, then everyone would see it that way. Absolutely everyone would. Yeah? Because it would be in that phenomena, that person. But it's not so. So you realize that there's so many causes and conditions, like in a family situation, we can get a whole lot of other family members to agree with us about that family member. Yeah? Or that particular person that we work with, wherever our work situation is. And we can get a lot of support, you know, endorsing that situation as well. So to look and watch and see how, you know, it is a dependent arising. It doesn't arise in a vacuum that anger occurs. Okay, so let's look at some of these verses from Shotadeva. Okay, So from the verse on the chapter on patience, Shantideva says, whatever befalls me, I shall not disturb my mental joy. For having made me unhappy, I shall not accomplish what I wish, and my virtues will decline. I'll read it again. Whatever befalls me, I shall not disturb my mental joy. For having made me unhappy, I shall not accomplish what I wish, and my virtues will decline. So you realize, you know, a lot of these, when unhappiness arises in us, when hatred or anger arises in us, you know, what Shantideva is saying, it's a mental attitude that arises in our experience. And usually what we do is we identify with it, and we cling on to it, and we run with it. And then it has all the power over us. Right? We embody that negative, upsetting mental attitude rather than saying and seeing, you know, it's, oh, this aversion is coming up, there it comes again, and letting it go. It's a passing, impermanent phenomenon. You know? It's just transitory as well. So there it goes, it's arising and subsiding. You know? So to watch and work with it in that way. You realize, yeah, when we become unhappy and depressed and upset about things, yeah, then we lose our energy, we lose our clarity, we start focusing our upset and our disturbed mind out and projecting it out onto other things, rather than realizing that upset has arisen in us, you know, and working with it from there. Because it debilitates us. It wipes us out. Okay, so the next verse is, why be unhappy about something if it can be remedied? And what is the use of being unhappy about something if it cannot be remedied? So, another way of saying it, is, if you can do something about it, why be angry? And if you can't do anything about it, why be angry? yeah.
I guess the word also is like worry. You know, why worry if you can't do anything about it? And worry doesn't help. It's the same kind of thing. Our mind just goes round and round.
Right.
You should just let it go.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very powerful one. But if there is something you can do about it, then you should do something about it, you know, and not just let it be there, like, you know, a thorn in your sock, and you just keep walking on it. Okay, the next verse is, for myself and for my friends, I want no suffering, no disrespect, no harsh words, and nothing unpleasant. But for my enemies, it's the opposite. This is totally running out the eight worldly concerns and looking at how we polarize and project upon things, and how, in fact, you know, again, our friends, our realm of friends constantly changes, our realm of strangers and enemies constantly changes as well. They're not a solid, independent, separate group either. And so, again, you know, looking at how factors arise to cause the upset in us, I wanted to read something because I've been dealing with war a little bit. And I thought that this fit in really well here. Okay? Force, this is written by someone named Simone Weil. Force is as pitiless to a man who possesses it or thinks he does, as it is to its victims. The second it crushes, the first it intoxicates. Okay. I'll read this one again. Force is as pitiless to a man who possesses it, or thinks he does, as it is to its victims. The second it crushes, the first it intoxicates. So force or anger or upset, right, is crushes its victims, intoxicates the person who possesses it. Yeah. Just like that, when you watch, when the delusion of anger arises in us, you know, we feel like it's going to give, it gives us a lot of energy, and we feel like we can finally say what we've been meaning to say, but it comes out in invective and harsh words and really painful cutting words that wipe out and blast things. And so, you know, it's like in one moment of anger, it totally obliterates all the things that we're trying to accumulate in cultivating a relationship or a friendship with others. Okay. Tarsa?
I've been noticing that there's another form of anger that's sort of a combination of attachment and hatred. It's resentment. It's almost like I was thinking about it in terms of a hurt museum. It's like these beautiful little figurines that you could take out of the case and look at them and think about, oh, look about the time they did this and this and this to me. And the first feeling of it is it is sort of an intoxication. It is sort of what you're talking about first, but then it does sort of tend to take over as well. It's such a stuck, sort of stagnant emotion, because you have attachment and you also have anger and hurt and everything. But you know, like you said, it doesn't really have any, it doesn't have any substance to it at all. You know, because it's obviously something that's happened in the past. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of, it can also sort of dissolve in your hand at the same time.
Yeah. We cling to it. Yeah. Uh-huh. Robert?
Would you read the quote one more time?
Yeah. Force is as pitiless to the man who possesses it, or thinks he does, as it is to its victims. The second it crushes, the first it intoxicates. So I wanted to read on this quote. It's actually a very old quote. It's by David Hume from 1740. For those of you who don't know, I was the Buddhist chaplain at the Air Force Academy for 6 years. So I worked with cadets through the through 9/11, and it is kind of intoxicating, actually. but let me read this. When our own nation is at war with any other, we detest them under the character of cruel perfidias, which means treacherous, unfaithful, or disloyal, yeah? Unjust and violent, but always esteem ourselves and allies, equitable, moderate, and merciful. If the general of our enemies be successful, 'tis with difficulty we allow him the figure and character of a man. He is a sorcerer. He has a communication with demons, and his report, as reported by Oliver Cromwell and the Duke of Luxembourg, he is bloody-minded and takes pleasure in death and destruction. That's the enemy, right? Okay, but if the success be on our side, our commander has all the opposite good qualities and is a pattern of virtue as well as of courage and conduct. His treachery we call policy. His cruelty is an evil inseparable from war. In short, every one of his faults we either endeavor to extenuate or dignify it with the name of that virtue which approaches it. It is evident the same method of thinking runs through our common life. Huh? Robert?
Wouldn't that be how the war is created in the first place? Because if we didn't see that division and labeling and violent thought towards each other, we would never experience seeing war.
Yeah, exactly, Robert. And this is what happens when that unpleasant feeling arises. Then if we grasp onto it, we play with it and toy with it, and we fan it into a fire, you know? And you think about what fire does is it consumes, yeah? This rage within us just wipes out any of our own virtue inside us. And when it occurs, you know, you watch how we just wipe out others with that through fanning the fire of upset and unpleasantness in us. But it also talks, you know, it's like this is a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. It's a force that gives us meaning. And so it talks about how we develop, cultivate war in a mythical sense. And when we do it in a mythical sense, then it polarizes that way. And he's saying, you know, as a force that gives us meaning, then life becomes very clear. Everything is black and white. You know, there's the perceived enemy, and you are right, and you go out there and take care of it. And you have a lot of energy, and you can act on it. Yeah? Whereas when you see the reality of war, then you can see it's chaos, it's craziness, it's killing and doing things that we would not ordinarily engage in our life, if not, you know. And we fan this fire of war. It's like this one historian said, he calculated that there have only been 29 years in all of human history during which a war was not underway somewhere. Okay, so in all of human history, 29 years when we have not been in a war somewhere. And you think about how we're developing more and more powerful weapons, more and more powerful weapons. So where are we headed, given the fact that we're doing this? It's very scary, okay? So let me read this one thing, okay? So he just says, just look at the 1990s, okay? So that's only, this is 2008. So we're eight years away from the 1990s, okay? This is what happened in the 1990s. 2 million dead in Afghanistan, 1.5 million dead in the Sudan, some 800,000 butchered in 90 days in Rwanda. So in 3 months, we killed about 800,000 people. 500,000 dead in Angola, 250,000 dead in Bosnia, 200,000 dead in Guatemala, 150,000 dead in Liberia, 250,000 dead in Burundi, 75,000 dead in Algeria, and untold tens of thousands lost in the border conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea, the fighting in Colombia, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Chechnya, Sri Lanka, southeastern Turkish, Sierra Leone, Northern Ireland, Kosovo, and the Persian Gulf War, where perhaps as many as 35,000 Iraqi citizens were killed. In the wars of the 20th century, not less than 62 million civilians have perished, almost 20 million more than the 43 million military personnel killed. Okay? So, I mean, war is an incredible extreme of hatred and anger that arises in us, you know, when we look at what arises in our mental continuum, you know, which is why, and they say so often in these wars that are driven, that they're driven by greed and lies.
Is it accurate to say that 29 years are a collective 29 years, or there was a period of 29? Collective, right?
I would say collective. Yeah. You know, one time I saw in the newspaper a small little article, and it said, we're just celebrating this day because on this day there was no war. I forget when it was. I should have cut it out.
The universe was that.
Way smart.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, realize that from this sense of unpleasantness and then fired by the other delusions of greed, and acquisition, jealousy, competitiveness, you know, what we engage in and what we do, it's really quite horrible. You know, when we think about ourselves as so evolved and dignified, it's not, you know, we're not doing very well, actually. Okay, so last verse here. Did you have a question? No? Okay, last verse. The causes of happiness sometimes occur. But causes for suffering are very many. Without suffering, there is no renunciation. Therefore, mind, you should stand firm. Okay, the first two lines. The causes of happiness sometimes occur, but causes for suffering are very many. Okay, so, you know, realizing that we are in samsara. We are in samsara. And as much as we want happiness, we all want happiness and don't want suffering. That it's a condition of our life to be in samsara. Yeah. And also, go back to the Four Noble Truths. Yeah, noble truth of suffering, cause of suffering, and the third noble truth is? Cessation. It's possible. It's actually possible. But, you know, given what I just read, you realize what we're up against, right? So when people talk about how, you know, in karmic conditions, say, you know, how can an innocent child have to experience this? How can I have, you know, I never did anything wrong to anyone? When you really think about karma and rebirth and how we act, even with being born as a human, how we've been, you know, we've been pretty vicious. And yet we think that we've all got halos around our heads. You know, when someone insults us, you know, it's like, gosh, me? I'm innocent of this. But you realize, you know, this whole practice of karma ripening upon us, coming to fruition, coming from causes and conditions of the past. And so, you know, how do we transform that into practice rather than perpetuating the eye for an eye view, which only continues to fan the fires of hatred and anger and killing? So to look, you know, the causes of suffering are many, but the Buddha said it's possible to attain liberation from this. It's possible, right? And if it weren't possible, we don't need any spiritual practice, right? If it weren't possible, then don't bother trying to find a source of it and just go live a heinous, what do they call that? A hedonistic life, right? Just go live a hedonistic life if there's no relief. Yeah, exactly. So, without suffering, there is no renunciation. Therefore, mind, you should stand firm. Okay. So it's looking at the that the suffering is like that thorn in your sock or that thorn in your side, saying, you know, wake up. It isn't all pleasurable. You know, as much as we run after trying to make our lives pleasurable, as much as we try to make our lives as sweet as we can, you know, it's going to come at us. It's going to get us in some way or another. And so to realize, you know, that's our opportunity to practice. That's our opportunity to transform and transcend the usual way we operate, which is the eight worldly concerns of running after pleasure. So to look at how can we use our suffering, use that family member, yeah, and to realize we need to gain more and more tools, to effectively work with others. Skillful means, skillful words, skillful talents, so that we can really help end the suffering, not only for ourselves but for others. You know, you know when you say the right thing, it just goes right in, and they get it. You know, they get it, you get it, and you know it. And so it's like, how do we cultivate and really develop the skills so that we can work with others to, you know, help bring liberation and peace and happiness in the world. But it really takes amazing skill, especially with those difficult people. You know, I mean, it's much easier to avoid. But what you avoid persists, doesn't it? So it's this side of, you know, how do we skillfully deal with that so that we can resolve it, resolve the wrong action or the unpleasant ways of others, so that our world can be more peaceful. Okay, so let's sit quietly with that. I'll read this last one, and for those of you who can read it, it's by the Buddha. And read it loud so everybody can hear. Hatred does not end by hatred. Hatred ends by love. This is an eternal law. Okay, so we'll sit with that for 5 minutes. So look at the hatred and anger in your own life and your own challenges in your own life, and also the war that continues on in the world around us. Thank you. to realize that love is the elixir. That melts barriers. And that we really need to continually cultivate patience and tolerance and more skillful means. Okay, so we had a request for some mantra prayers for Kobe.
Cubby.
Do you want to share with everyone who Cubby was? Do you want to share who Cubby was?
Cubby was our dog. It was a stray dog we found some years back. Terrible shape, got better shape. And when we went to India, he stayed with our good friend Andrew, who's here today. And then we came back a few days ago, and we haven't seen him yet, but he died, I think, the night we came back or something. So he was pretty blind and deaf by the time he went, but quite a character.
And he didn't have much hair, right?
Not on the back part of his body. When we found him, he had mange, and his teeth were all worn down, and lesions, and all kinds of unattractive stuff. But he was a fine fellow.
Oh. Okay.
Can we also give prayers for one of our whole sisters? She was 75, and she passed away just last month. Janine.
Okay. Also, last week, Venerable Losang Sultan and I went to visit someone, a filmmaker who was passing away. We were able to do prayers that night for him, and he passed about 2 hours later. And his name was Michael Taylor. He made two documentary films on His Holiness, and we're going to be going up again today to meet with his wife.
I'd like to include my brother, Ashley Anthony Cunningham, who died December 16th last year. He was an astrophysicist. He was the person who told them where to direct the micro telescope, whatever, to the far reaches of the expanding universe. He was an amazing man, and we lived in each other's parallel universes. I was part of his universe. I was a blue angel. I was the only human being in my brother's life, and my brother died of starvation, because we live in a society that frankly doesn't. So I'd like to include my brother Anthony Ashley Cunningham.
Okay, for our friends and for all beings, let's say the Tenrezi mantra. So when you say the mantras, you can imagine, you can call to mind Tenrezi, the Buddha of compassion, and rays of light from Tenrezi's heart go out in all directions Shinrezi, the Buddha of compassion, manifested as His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And these rays of compassion and loving kindness go out to our friends and to all beings everywhere. Guiding them on their path and washing away all suffering and sickness. Here you will see the dedication. Jim, you know, I think you're correct about this, that we do it when we dedicate our merits to enlightenment, that they hang in there till the end. Mm-hmm. But in His Holiness's book, he was saying that if it's practices like generosity and things, you know, until you have the wisdom of emptiness or those insights into emptiness are what don't get destroyed. So I don't know. We have to do a very strong dedication, I think. Okay, so dedicate your merits so that we can overcome our anger and hatred, overcome our attachment and jealousy and benightedness, so that we can be of the greatest benefit to others and attain enlightenment quickly. Because of these merits, may we quickly become Guru Lord Buddha and lead each and every sentient being into His enlightened realm. May the precious bodhicitta that has not yet been received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. May the precious view of emptiness, shunyata, that has not been received, be received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. By the virtue of offering to you assembly of Buddhas, visualize before me this mandala built on a base, resplendent with flowers, saffron, water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and moon. May all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamneya Tayami. In the land of snowy mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. Lord Shinrezi Tenzin Gyatso, may you stay until samsara ends. Let's see. I am going to need some help either after class or right after lunch. We have the newsletter, which is already obsolete, but needs to be mailed out. And so if people can help with that, that would be greatly appreciated. I think the more people, the quicker we can get it done. And then I'll post the calendar outside if you want. Classes continue as usual. And then we have Tibetan Losar, Tibetan New Year, on February 7th. At 7 a.m. we'll have prayers and breakfast here, and Sunday, September 10th, will be the next observance of the... I'm sorry?
September.
I'm sorry, Sunday, the February 10th. Sorry, thank you. It will be the 24-hour Mahayana precepts again at 6 a.m. And Geshe Gelson will be back on Wednesday. So... we look forward to maybe changing the calendar a little bit. So March was going to be a practice month, but we'll see. Geshe-la is going to see how things go, and we may need to issue a new calendar depending on that.
Geshe-la's flight arrives at 12:20 p.m. at the international at Tom Bradley International Terminal at LAX. If anybody wants to greet him, I don't know. Of course, how long it will take him to come through customs, but hopefully very quickly.
Yeah, that means lunchtime. Okay. Okay, so we'll do our vows together.